Again, the case is Bowles v. Midwest Sheet Metal Company. You may proceed. Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is John Fowles. I'm the attorney representing the plaintiff in this case. Stacy Bowles is personal representative of the estate of Greg Bowles. This case, there's a, you call it loosely a companion case, Bowles 1. In Bowles 1, the trial court found that Greg Bowles sustained a heart attack in the course and scope of his employment. The court entered an award accordingly, and this court affirmed that award. This case, which I will call Bowles 2, shares only a few things really in common with Bowles 1. The employee, Gregory Bowles, is at issue. His heart attack is at issue, and the defendant is the same. But what is distinctly different in this case, Bowles 2, is the benefits being sought. They come under a different statute. In Bowles 1, the statute at issue was 48, 122, 123, and 124, and the dependent benefits available under those statutes. Additionally, we have a separate and distinct plaintiff. In Bowles 1, we had the dependents, the people who have an entitlement to bring a direct action because of their relationship to Gregory Bowles. And also, we have a different beneficiaries of the benefits that are available under the workers' compensation statutes. In Bowles 2, we had dependent benefits at issue. In this case, we have medical benefits that presumably, if they were ultimately awarded, would go to the estate or be paid directly to the medical providers pursuant to statute.
Even though you say you have different plaintiffs between the two cases, in actuality, do you?
Oh, I think certainly, most certainly, Your Honor. I mean, you have the personal representative who is the successor in interest to all the rights that Gregory Bowles had while he was living, which would be the medical benefits and potentially indemnity benefits.
And that's really the surviving spouse, yeah. Isn't it?
Well, she's the personal representative.
Right.
But in Bowles 2, or in Bowles 1, you have to understand, Your Honor, that the dependents were the beneficiaries. That included her children. That included her. So if you want to think about this in a logical sense, any benefits, I mean, it causes almost confusion, potentially, because the benefits that would be awarded would go to the, in Bowles 1, go solely to the dependents, whereas if you intermix the medical benefits, which would go to the estate, or really part of the estate, they're not a belonging of the, or a property right of the dependents, which included her children, which included her. So I think the plaintiffs are really distinct, because one was a personal representative, the successor in interest to Gregory Bowles. In the other case, it was the dependents who have their own interests at issue.
So in Bowles 1, was there a pending workers' compensation action filed by Mr. Bowles before he died?
No.
So is that distinguishable from Olivato in that regard?
Yes, I think Olivato is different in that, I mean, Olivato said that you, I mean, in Olivato, yes, he was living, and then he died, and they stipulated that his wife could bring his claim. That was a stipulation.
So that's okay. Different than what we have had, yes. In Bowles 1, is that correct?
Yes, yeah. Yes. Bowles 1, he died pretty much immediately. So he had a heart attack and he died on the spot.
And then an action was brought pursuant to 48-122 for dependent benefits.
Dependent benefits, yes.
As opposed to benefits that the decedent may have been entitled to.
Correct.
Previously.
Correct. Yes.
Was there a reason the medical benefits were not sought in Bowles 1?
Well, yeah, there's a couple reasons, Your Honor. First of all, the way I read the statute, I didn't think the dependents could bring the action. Okay, I did not see the Olivato case, which seems to say that they can, but in my mind, I was thinking in terms of the typical wrongful death claim where you have the dependents have their, I mean, the next of kin have their claim for the wrongful death, whereas the estate has its claim for the medical, pain and suffering up to the date of death. So it's really two different distinct claims. And so I didn't think that the dependents could make the claim for the medical benefits. Now, Olivato seems to say otherwise, but it says you can. I don't think it's a must. I don't think that you have to. And the other reason was when Gregory Bowles died, we didn't get to talk to Greg Bowles. We didn't know what happened. We didn't know whether we had much of a case or not. Ultimately, we did, but we didn't know that. So you're going to go out and make an estate, open yourself up to claims, open yourself up to all the things that can come in terms of opening an estate and pursue those too. We decided that in my mind, we could make this claim at any time. So we pursued the claim, and as the statute of limitations approached, the case had not been decided. We filed the claim for the medical benefits. It was stayed pending the outcome of the appeal, and that's how we chose to pursue it. And I think that's our prerogative to pursue it that way. Now the court the trial court judge, who I have a lot of respect for, he tried to say, well, we're trying to make more work than we needed to. That's really the only work, more work that was created was by their claiming that we couldn't do this way. I mean, otherwise, it would have been a pretty easy case. If we can bring the claim, you know, I think issue preclusion certainly applies. I think claim preclusion is a different issue.
What was it your position in this case that the decision in Bowles 1 was binding in terms of causation and things like that?
Yes. Issue preclusion, I agree, applies. And I think if you look at the Hera versus Reichardt case, the court said very specifically you can have issue preclusion and not claim preclusion. They're different. They have different basis. And so I think even though I do agree that there's issue preclusion, I don't think that means you don't have, I think you can still not have claim preclusion.
Isn't the problem that Arbauer does indicate that you can bring the claims together?
It seems to say you can, but I don't know why that means you have to.
If you can and you choose not to, when does claim preclusion come into effect?
No, it doesn't, because they're different causes of action. They're really different claims. One is a claim for medical benefits. The other is a claim for the dependent benefits. They go different directions. They're different causes of action, Your Honor. And I don't know that there's anything that says, I mean, I think the claim preclusion comes into play when you're making the same claim twice. We're not making the same claim twice. We're making a claim for medical benefits and a claim for dependent benefits. They're separate, distinct. They go to different people. They go to different places. If you combine the two, you potentially have conflicts of interest, Your Honor. You bring in anyone who has a claim for those medical benefits. That could be creditors. That could be subrogation claims. It really opens up a Pandora's box that you might not appreciate unless you're a plaintiff's attorney, but there are different interests in the medical benefits as opposed to the beneficiary benefits or the dependent benefits. You know, different people have different interests in those two claims, and I don't think it's troublesome possibly to combine the two. So
in this particular case, while Bowles 1 was pending, Midwest filed a motion to either stay or dismiss,
yes.
I believe was the language. And then it came on as a motion to dismiss.
Yes, I think there are procedural issues, too, and I want to get to that, too, Your Honor. But did you have a question, I guess?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that was really not the proper motion to do this. The court never decided whether there was privity. I mean, the court seems to assume privity, but never said there was privity, never said why there was privity. And I think also the threshold question in the motion to dismiss is whether it states a cause of action. The petition clearly stated a cause of action. Clearly, no one says otherwise. The court kind of jumped to the end, which is the question of whether claim preclusion or issue, but it didn't do all the things in the meantime that I think it needed to do to reach that conclusion. So I think it creates a Rule 11 issue because we don't know how the court came to this conclusion about privity. There was no evidence offered. So I think there are procedural problems, and I think there's also substantive problems. I think if they were going to bring this motion to dismiss this case, it should have been a motion for summary judgment rather than a motion to dismiss.
And is that one of the problems here, is that what started out as a motion to dismiss ended up becoming a motion for summary judgment?
I don't think it did, because that gets a tricky question, Your Honor. I understand what you're getting to, and I was pretty clear when I said at the beginning of the case, that this, to clarify the court, this is not a motion for summary judgment, this is a motion to dismiss. I said that on the record, no one said otherwise. You know, the court can take judicial notice of a file and not convert it to a motion for summary judgment. I think that's what it did in this case. There's no evidence.
Is that all there was? There was no other evidence offered?
Yeah.
It was just the court file?
Yes. Just judicial notice.
And was that basically the court file of Bowles 1?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
All right.
I'd like to preserve the remainder for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Darla Aguios on behalf of the defendant. I'd like to first speak to the procedural issues that have been raised by the plaintiff, and I think the procedural issues are whether the motion to dismiss was sufficiently stated, and also whether claim preclusion can be an appropriate subject matter for a motion to dismiss. The motion to dismiss that was filed, it could have been better worded. Let's put it that way. I think certainly the focus of that motion and the language of the motion was on the stay part of that motion. Nonetheless, our courts have made it clear that for a motion to dismiss, the party does not have to specify the ground in 6-1112B6. The court's going to look at the substance rather than the form of the motion. If you look at the record, I think it's very clear the basis for the motion to dismiss is failure to state a claim. And it's failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted because of claim preclusion. That's what the parties argued to the trial court, and that was the basis for the court's ultimate order.
And your position in that motion to dismiss was the fact that the claim was precluded because they could have brought the claim in Bowles 1. Is that correct?
Correct. It was based on claim preclusion.
Did it specifically say that, this idea?
The motion?
The motion itself?
The motion itself was a motion to grant a stay or in the alternative dismiss.
It doesn't really say for what reason that you're filing the motion to dismiss.
That is correct. And that's why I say it certainly could have been better worded. I don't think there's any question that that was the issue that both parties discussed at the hearing.
I know you're familiar with the workers' comp rules of procedure, and you know that the rules specifically state that the issues that are to be presented are supposed to be specifically set out. And there's a case that says that the rules can supersede the statutes. And so if that's the case, then do we have a situation here where we at least have to address whether or not proper notice was given to the plaintiff to prepare for the motion to dismiss? I understand that's what was argued, but just from a purely legal standpoint of following along with what the rules say, is that a problem we at least have to address?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the case law makes clear that when you file a motion to dismiss, you don't have to specify the particular defense.
Workers' comp?
No, I'm talking about the 12B6.
The general.
Yeah.
But the workers' comp rules can supersede that.
But I think if there was any type of issue that the plaintiff didn't have proper notice of what the basis for the motion is, that should have and could have been raised at the hearing. It wasn't because, again, the parties knew the basis for the claim. The plaintiff was offered and took the ability to submit a written brief, which he did. So nobody came into that surprised by the substance of it, and I don't think anybody was prejudiced by it.
What case or what statute or rule do you think is your strongest argument as to why they were required to bring this claim in Bowles 1?
There's a few things. Claim preclusion, okay? It bars litigation of a claim that was addressed or could have been addressed in the first proceeding. The case of Norlanco, 186 Nebraska 100, I think that has some interesting language that was not included in our brief. And that case says, the doctrine of res judicata is much broader than a determination of the questions involved in the first action. The conclusiveness of the judgment in such case extends not only to matters actually determined, but to other matters which could have been raised and determined. The rule applies to every question relevant to and falling within the purview of the original action in respect to matters both claim or grounds of recovery. I think that language is spot on with the issues we're presented with. We know from our cases that spouses can recover medical benefits. That's in Olivetto. Olivetto, when it decided that case, referred to 48.122. Which identifies the ongoing obligation of employers to pay medical expenses to a dependent following the death. Olivetto also cited two other cases where the spouses recovered medical benefits.
But do you see a distinction here in that there was no pending action by the employee at the time of death? So at that point in time, at time of death, under 48.122, a dependent could make a claim for the burial expenses and so forth. but no decision has yet been made or no request for any benefits for the employee pursuant to the Workers' Compensation Act.
When I read Alameda, I don't think that that court focuses on the fact that the parties were substituted. So I understand your question. I don't think it makes a difference. The two cases that are cited as the basis for that rule in Alameda, neither one of those cases, quite frankly, really discuss it.
Right.
But I think, if I'm remembering correctly, those cases started out as spouse, and there was not that substitution that took place in Alameda. One thing I also want to address, plaintiff talks about negligence and wrongful death cases and refers the court to the statutes and case law pertinent to that. And I just want to convey to this court that I don't think that is analogous to this situation. The Workers' Compensation Court is a special tribunal. It has its own statutory framework. In the workers' compensation cases, medical benefits, when they are ordered to be paid, they are not ordered to be paid to the plaintiff. They don't go into the hands of a spouse, a dependent, whoever it is. Medical benefits are ordered to be paid to the provider or the payor.
But it's on behalf of the employee, though, isn't it?
I think that's fair.
Okay, so doesn't standing of the plaintiff still matter? And by that I mean either it has to be the plaintiff himself or it has to be an appointed representative of the plaintiff. And when you're dealing with medical bills that are being sought after somebody dies, I mean, it does matter then who's bringing that claim, doesn't it?
I don't think it does matter because regardless of who your plaintiff is, those bills are always going to be paid to the provider. They're never going to fall into the hands of a dependent, whereas in negligence or wrongful death instances, if a defendant is ordered to pay medical bills, those medical bills go to the hands of the plaintiff.
But it's the right of the employee to have those payments made if the liability is established. So in this case, for example, if as the wife, Mrs. Bowles, went to seek payment of the medical bills, she wouldn't have had any standing to bring a claim on that basis. She could only come in as a PR of the estate to do that, right?
I disagree. I think Oliveto clearly says spouse as dependent can seek medical benefits.
Oliveto was trying to address a situation where the wife stepped in to a pending action as opposed to a spouse coming in after a death with no pending action. Seems like there's a little bit of a distinction there. You don't agree, I understand.
I don't. Based on the reasoning of Oliveto, which looked at the statutory language, which says the medical bills are an ongoing obligation of the employer, and based upon the cases that were cited in support of the finding in Oliveto.
Well, so since there was a determination of liability, why aren't the bills paid? Why is there a need to bring an action to pay the bills then?
Medical bills have never been presented.
So if they're presented, they'd get paid without having to go through the court?
I don't have an answer to that question. Medical bills have never, they were not included because they weren't offered as evidence in Bowles 1, which they could have been, and our position is that they should have been.
That's the key, is that they had to have been.
Yes. If you look at the underlying policy of claim preclusion, it's so that we're not relitigating matters in front of the court. That's very consistent with the Workers' Compensation Act purpose,
what would be relitigated?
I'm sorry?
What would be relitigated?
I do not dispute Mr. Fowle's position that issue preclusion. I do think that applies. I don't think anything needs to be relitigated.
I don't see what we're establishing, you know, for what benefit other than the employer.
What about funeral expenses? Can he bring another claim for funeral expenses? Of course not. That could have been and should have been litigated the first time. And the same is true, respectfully, with regard to the medical bills.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. How much time?
Hey, Your Honor, with respect to one question was asked just recently about the medical, they were not claimed. It was that the petition in Bowles 1 clearly stated benefits due and owing under 48-122, 123, 124, the death dependent statutes. Olivetto seems to say she could have brought the claim, but it doesn't mean she had to bring the claim. And I think that's the distinction. Being able to do something and having to do something are two completely different things.
When you talk about issue preclusion, you say that it's something that had to have been brought or should have been brought or could have been brought. And Olivetto says it could have been brought. So once you run right into the same problem, you didn't bring it, you could have brought it, you chose not to bring it.
But it has to do with the privity issue. We have the personal representative does not share privity necessarily with the dependent. That's why you have two different claims. I agree, Stacey Bowles can't come back and make that claim. The dependents can't come back and make that claim. We're not making a claim for funeral expenses. I agree they can't make that claim. But the medical expenses belong also to the estate. And the estate is who's making that claim. The estate can't make the claim for the dependent benefits. They're different rights.
But the money would come to the estate.
I think ultimately it would, yes.
It would go to the providers.
Yeah, well, I've... doing this for years, a lot of times the money comes right to the plaintiff, first of all. And secondly, I think if the plaintiff paid those, then they got to go back somewhere. And that's the other issue. If the estate paid them, then they have to go back to the estate.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you both. The case is submitted. All right, the next case is Kaysen versus Kaysen.